Okay, welcome to the Accessibility Online. Today's session is Accessible Museums. I'd like to welcome your moderator for today's session, Peggy Greenwell from the U.S. Access Board.
Thanks, Claudia, and welcome everyone to our session on Accessible Museum Exhibits. I do want to make an announcement, however, before we start into this session, and the announcement is that this will actually be my last webinar. It turns out that I am retiring at the end of the month, and I just wanted to let you know that I've always appreciated the support that of those of you that participate in our sessions. And when we started the program 6 years ago, we really weren't sure how it was going to be received. And we have learned a lot from your evaluations about how we're doing, and I want to encourage you to continue to provide feedback. Not only about the sessions that you're participating in, but also about sessions that you would like to see the board do in the future, because we do really rely on that feedback to plan our program. So, you know, again, I thank you for your support and participation, and I hope you continue to do that in the future. And I hope that this information does help you get a better understanding of the accessibility standards. So with that, let me go ahead and move on to slide 12, which is a chance to introduce our two presenters for today's session. So our first presenter is Marcia Maz. Many of you know her. She's a frequent presenter in our webinar series, as well as a presenter elsewhere. She is the director of the Office of Technical and Information Services, and she's been with the board since 1989. In addition to all the responsibilities that she has here at the board, she also serves as the board's representative to the Model Code organizations and is a member of ANSI A117 and NFPA, National Fire Protection Association Disability Access Review Committee. So after Marcia presents, we will be hearing from Michelle Hartley. Michelle is the Media Accessibility Coordinator from the Harpers Ferry Center for Media Services of the National Park Service. She provides review and support of the Harpers Ferry Center staff and parks on media accessibility, such as exhibits, videos, and publications. She also has provided accessibility training and delivered numerous presentations throughout the National Park Service and for the Department of Interior. And then prior to her current position, she was an audiovisual producer and the acting director, associate manager of the Harpers Ferry Center's Audiovisual Arts Department. She holds a bachelor's in English Literature and a Master's in Folk Studies. She's also a recipient of the Roger Kennedy National Parks Fellowship at the George Washington University. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Marcia.
Thank you, Peggy. And I want to say publicly here that we will be looking for somebody to do your job in the near future, but we're not going to be able to replace you. And it's been a lot of years, and I certainly will miss you. So our session agenda here really involves communication barriers, and we are going to be talking about those communication barriers that are addressed by the standards and those that are addressed by the Department of Justice ADA regulations. And then we'll also be talking about media accessibility highlights from the National Park Service. So without any further ado, let's go on to slide 14 and to slide 15. Okay, the first communication barrier that we want to talk about here is protruding objects. This is going to be an overview for a lot of you, but please bear with me as we briefly go through what the ADA standards say about protruding objects. Slide 16, please. So the first thing that I think is important for every museum operator to know is that the prohibition against having objects protrude applies to all circulation paths, not just to accessible routes. Oftentimes we get this kind of question, well, you know, this just applies in on accessible routes, right? Oh no, it applies on any circulation path, anywhere a person walks or circulates, including in toilet rooms. And again, we get this question quite frequently. This illustration on this page shows the sort of a summary of the requirements, a 4-inch maximum protrusion. That 4-inch maximum protrusion is allowed at 27 to 80 inches. So the 27-inch, anything below 27 inches can protrude any amount. Anything above 80 inches can protrude any amount. But in that protected zone, 27 to 80 inches measured vertically, nothing can protrude more than 4 inches into a circulation path. Next slide, please. Here's an example of a simple 4-inch protrusion. It is just a rail or potentially a board or something that might be put underneath the monitor. Sometimes you see these or a small writing surface. Again, 4-inch maximum protrusion unless a portion of this rail is located 27 inches or lower. Slide 18. When you measure that 4 inches, you measure it based on where the circulation path is. So you'll note in this example, which shows something like a shelf with a very long base, the base itself goes well below 27 inches, almost to the floor. So you're measuring the protrusion, the lip, that hangs off that base, because essentially what you've done is you've pushed the circulation path further into the hallway at that point. So you get 4 inches from the vertical plane defined by the base of the shelf. This is particularly handy in exhibits, again, where you may have some writing surface or some other surface that you're going to put beneath a display. Slide 19. Here's just a quick illustration of that 27-inch max. As long as you hit 27 inches with the bottom of this drinking fountain, you're fine. You can protrude as much as you want. But if, for example, the drinking fountain were to be, or any element were to be higher than 27 inches, it wouldn't be permitted. Now, this is handy since 27 inches also defines the knee height for knee and toe clearance underneath the drinking fountain. Slide 20. Here's just an image of a person walking along the corridor and coming into contact with the drinking fountain. And you note the angle of the cane. This person is using the cane in the way one might, white cane, in the way one might normally use it as they're walking in an uncrowded and unrestricted space. And you see where the cane contacts the bottom edge of the drinking fountain at 27 inches, allowing the user a step or two stopping distance. And so that 27 inches is pretty critical, particularly based on the average sized white cane user. If the person is significantly shorter or significantly taller, the cane is going to intersect at a different point. Or if they're holding their cane close to their body and more vertically, the cane will intersect at a different point. People tend to hold their canes far more vertically in crowded situations where the traffic pattern isn't clear. And I would suggest that in a museum, that may be the case. You may have people circulating all around a room and there's not a clear traffic pattern. So a person with a disability may in fact hold that cane more vertically so as not to trip people, among other things. And if they do, they have much less stopping distance for a protruding object. You might want to bear that in mind particularly in museum spaces where you don't want someone to get tangled up in something that's protruding out, because if they do fall, heaven knows where they're going to land. Slide 21. This is an example of the cane detection area beneath an open stairway. For a long time, I've been advising folks never, ever to let that cane detection barrier resemble a stair or a step. Because if it does resemble a stair or a step, the consequence is that a person who's using a cane may, in fact, read that surface as a step and step up into the overhead barrier, really injuring themselves. Now, if you'll note where the planter, in this case, underneath the stairs is located, you would measure this by plumbing down from wherever the barrier exists, from the underside of the stair, and you would place the barrier where you get that 80-inch height. So anything higher than 80 inches is fine, not a problem. But where you get to 80 inches, where you plumb down, take a plumb line and plumb down, and then at 80 inches, that's where you'll build your cane detection barrier. Slide 22. Thank you. Okay. Now, this particular barrier, I think, is a little more effective, even though it's not solid, because it's not going to be red like a step. If you remember, the previous slide showed a fairly wide ledge around that planter. And if that's a concrete planter, it could very easily be red as a step. Slide 23. Okay. In this slide, we show something that is frequently done in existing facilities. We show an open stairway with a bunch of planters underneath, and those planters containing plants would prevent someone from actually getting to that 80-inch height and would prevent them from coming underneath the stair. Planters are fine in readily achievable barrier removal if it's not readily achievable to fully comply with the standards. But the standards, the ADA standards, are for fixed elements. So if you are doing an alteration or if you're undertaking new construction, your cane detection barrier needs to be a fixed element, not something that can migrate out of the way or be taken away because the plants have now died and they're ugly and the boss wants them out of sight. So you really do need to be mindful of that, and you need to make sure that anything you do to comply with the standards, in fact, is a permanently installed element, unless you're doing readily achievable barrier removal, and it is not readily achievable to fully comply with the standards. Slide 23. This is an example of that 80-inch barrier. What we're looking at here is a very nice kind of twisted sculpture, and it has a couple of points, arms like with points. And if you note, in the yellow shaded area, that's the where the protruding object exists, and the little fence around the sculpture actually keeps you from getting up underneath it, so it's not an overhead barrier. But if you look very closely at the yellow shading, you'll see that those pointed ends on the sculpture are extending beyond the shading. They're extending beyond where the railing is. And in this particular picture, they're aimed right at the throat of the young man using a cane who's standing at the sculpture. So that would be a pretty pointy thing to come in contact with. So you do need to think of this, particularly around sculptures and freestanding artifacts and things, as a volume, not just an overhead and get under kind of thing. You need to think about the entire volume of that space and protect that entire volume. Slide 24. Um, in terms of protruding objects, we find that oftentimes, particularly in outdoor environments, people do things that are attractive for sometimes, but also can constitute barriers. And in this particular example, we have a hanging pot, and that hanging pot with all of its beautiful flowers is, in fact, a protruding object, well above 27 inches, well below 80 inches, and you can see just barely the legs of a person on the opposite side of that hanging pot about to walk into it. And so this is, again, a concern. This would be a violation of the standards if that pot is protruding into a circulation path, which it clearly is. And the Department of Justice regulations, both Titles II and III, require covered entities to maintain accessible features. And that is not just for the built environment. It's also for your landscaping and other amenities that may find their way into being barriers within the built environment, even a wastebasket that migrates into a toilet stall, for example. Slide 26, sorry. For some reason, the slide numbers are not visible on my screen. But in any case, the next thing we want to talk about very quickly is signs, and I'm trying to be very clear here that we're not talking about exhibit labels or descriptions. We're talking about signs as we know and love them. Slide 27. Okay, the scoping for signs in the ADA standards is in Section 216. And one of the most frequently asked questions we get is about pictograms. We're often asked whether or not all pictograms, whether it's a no-smoking pictogram or some other pictogram, have to comply with the requirements for pictograms. No, they don't. Only those pictograms that are required to be provided, and some are, or those pictograms that designate a permanent room or space have to be raised letter and brailled. Also, we don't require very many signs. Most of the time, the requirements apply to signs when you either elect to provide them or you may have a code or other requirement that requires you to provide signs. The sign provisions in the ADA standards apply to both interior and exterior signs. There are limitations on the exterior signs in terms of those exterior signs that, for example, provide you direction to or information about spaces on the interior of the building. In other words, a sign that says entrance to auditorium on the outside of the building would in fact be required to be accessible if it's at that entrance. Next slide. Certain types of signs are exempt. Building addresses, by that we mean the postal address, 1331, for example. Company names and logos, occupant names, directories and menus. You can imagine how large directories and menus might become if they were required to meet even the visual requirements, let alone the raised letter and braille requirements. And temporary signs. And we define temporary signs as signs that are up for 7 days or less. So if you hand letter a sign for a special event or you put something up for a special event, if that event doesn't go on for more than 7 days, that sign is not required to be accessible. Slide 29. These are the required designations and the required pictograms. The International Symbol of Accessibility, the International TTY Symbol, the Volume Control Symbol, and the Assisted Living, Assisted Listening Symbol are all various pictograms that are required. And I'm not going to waste your time by telling you exactly where all these are required. It's very clear and very easy to look up. Slide 30. Now, with respect to the International Symbol of Accessibility, there are certain places where you're required to provide the ISA. And the ISA label is required at certain accessible locations. For example, it's required where not all doors are accessible, and that just happens fairly frequently in museums, particularly historic buildings where you have to direct people to another entrance as opposed to the main entrance. And when you don't have all entrances accessible, you not only have to label your accessible entrance, but you have to provide directional signs at the inaccessible entrances in order that people can find their way to the accessible locations. Slide 31. TTYs, and again, the sign is just there to let you know when a bank of phones contains a TTY. And we understand that banks of phones are disappearing, and this may not come into play hardly at all in the future. Slide 32. Volume control. All public phones must have volume controls, and you need to label the phones with the volume control symbol. Slide 34. Slide 33. Okay, assistive listening. Again, assistive listening is required in the standards for assembly areas. Michelle will talk about other places that it might be used, but it is specifically required for assembly areas in the standards. And in addition, you are required to display a sign at each assembly area or at the ticket office or window indicating the availability of assistive listening. Next slide. Where loops are provided, I recommend, this is not in the standards at this particular point in time, but I recommend that you augment the assistive listening symbol with the symbol for T-coil and enabled systems. Systems that people can use without a receiver if they have hearing aids that have T-coils or receivers built into them. This sign is very, very helpful to people who do have such equipped hearing aids because they know right from the get-go that they don't have to go seek somebody out. They don't have to figure out where the receivers are being handed out. They don't have to produce identification or anything else. And when I say produce identification, what I mean is they don't have to. I know, you know, oftentimes people are asked, well, will you leave your driver's license or will you leave your address or some way of us contacting you if you fail to return this. Obviously, you don't have to identify yourself as needing this amenity if you that would be a violation of the ADA. Okay, next slide. Now, signs that are required to have only visual access. Those are information and directional signs, and these are the only requirements that apply. Finish, contrast, the character, style and proportion, spacing, and we encourage upper and lowercase letters. Slide 35? Slide 36. Sorry. Okay, and just to make the point here, I have a slide here that says upper and lowercase are often easier to read than all uppercase, and this is in all uppercase. Again, for people with low vision, it seems counterintuitive, but in fact, everyone who reads visually reads better when you use upper and lower cases and not all uppercase. So, because when you render a sign in all uppercase, what happens is you lose the peaks and valleys and the overall architecture of that word is not as easy to read because it becomes just one big rectangle. Next slide. Signs designating permanent rooms and spaces must be tactile. And in this situation, in this example here, you see both a tactile, meaning raised number, 3239, and that raised number is duplicated, 3239, in Braille below. The standards don't require you to make both the number, the visual number, and the Braille visible. You note here that the raised 3239 is contrasting with the background, but the braille is not. The braille is not required to contrast with the background. Next slide. Again, raised characters on tactile signs must be uppercase letters. So for tactile signs, although we know that people read visually better when you use upper and lower case, the opposite is true when you're reading tactily. When you're reading tactily, you must use all uppercase letters because we don't people who read tactily don't often recognize lowercase letters. Grade 2 Braille is required, and I notice here I capitalized Braille, which I normally don't do because the Braille Authority of North America has decided that the word Braille is no longer capitalized, but it's hard to break old habits. Tactile signs must also provide visual access. So any sign that's required to be tactile is also required to be visually readable, finish, contrast, all of the other requirements. And it's also required to have its raised letters or characters in Braille. And again, only on signs that designate permanent rooms and spaces do you have to provide the pictogram with the descriptor where they designate a permanent room and space. An example here would be a pictogram that shows the International Women's Room symbol, and adjacent to it is a pictogram that shows the ISA. If that ISA is merely informational, in other words, this is an accessible restroom, it's not the name of the room, so the ISA is actually not required to be tactile, whereas the pictogram that designates or names the room is required to be tactile. Next slide. So again, we said that these requirements apply to all buildings, both in and all areas, interior and exterior. So again, restroom labels, for example, at the entry to the restroom, room numbers or names that are not likely to change. Floor level designations is something that is often overlooked because your floor level designations in an interior, in a stairway, for example, which may not be used often except as a means of egress, people very frequently forget that those are also designations of permanent rooms and spaces. So there must be tactile signs inside the stairway to designate those floor levels. And of course, we have special requirements for exit access, exit discharge, but the directional exit signs, again, are not required to be tactile, those directing you to an exit. And areas of refuge. Areas of refuge have specific requirements for both tactile and visual signs. Next slide. Assisted listening is the next area covered by the standards. Next slide. what an assistive listening system does is it brings the sound directly from the microphone to the hearing aid or ear, if you're using a headset, without picking up sound that's in the intervening space. This is very, very important where you have sound between the speaker and the hearer, shuffling around, people coughing, people talking. All of that sound is intervening sound is eliminated with an assistive listening system and is extremely helpful to someone who doesn't hear well. And so it is particularly important where you know you have a situation where your acoustics are poor. But an assistive listening system shouldn't be used to make up for poor acoustics. You really can't substitute for good acoustics. Good acoustics are important to all building occupants. But if you are aware that your space is acoustically poor, even more important to get a good quality, properly installed and properly maintained assistive listening system. Next slide. TTYs. As I said earlier, TTYs, next slide, are just about extinct these days. You find very few of them, very few properties anymore are installing payphones, or if they are, they're not installing big banks of them. There may be only one or two phones. The preference of many people in the deaf community is for a video phone as opposed to a TTY. And the reason that people do prefer these is that they can speak to one another in their native language. So you can have a conversation direct between two people who are deaf in sign language as opposed to having to type in English back and forth. And this does really facilitate conversation among deaf people. A TTY, a video phone, can be used by to call relay operators, and you can have a video relay call, or you can have your typical relay call with voice and then the relay operator typing back into a TTY. You may want to consider a video phone as equivalent facilitation to the TTY requirement in the standards. Next slide. Alarms. The whole issue of alarms could take up an entire webinar. That's not our main thrust here today, but just as a reminder, next slide, please. Visual fire alarms are required, and they do have to be available to notify all occupants of an emergency, even if you have a space that has very high ceilings, has a lot of partitions. You're going to have to work out the placement of those visible alarms so that everybody is notified when the alarms go off. And you cannot count on someone who is deaf or hard of hearing noticing that other people are panicking and then assuming that there's an emergency situation. That isn't effective communication. Next slide. There are many communications barriers not addressed by the ADA standards, and the Department of Justice ADA regulations really fill the gap. In fact, I would say that the Department of Justice ADA regulations when it comes to communications are far richer and contain far more requirements than the ADA standards and are more versatile. Next slide, please. And again, this is just a reminder to those of you who I'm sure already know that state and local governments have requirements for effective communication program access in subparts D and E of 28 CFR Part 35. And public accommodations have very similar, if not identical, requirements in 28 CFR Part 36. 36302, modifications of policies, practices, and procedures, which may require you to communicate differently with someone than you communicate generally with everyone else. Also, auxiliary aids and services. Auxiliary aids and services is a very, very broad requirement and could result in quite a number of different solutions, some of which Michelle will be going over in a few minutes. And lastly, removal of barriers. Removal of barriers also allows for certain enhancements to communication that really shouldn't be overlooked. Next slide. Department of Justice's effective communication auxiliary aids and services requirement, as I said before, is quite broad. What it means to me is that if you're communicating content to people, for example, people who see, for people who don't see or have low vision, you have to find a way to communicate that content to the people who have disabilities who can't access the various means of communication that you're making available. For example, who may not be able to access the kiosk that you're using or electronic communications may not be able to access the signage that labels the artifacts or describes the artifacts, which themselves are behind glass. Next slide, please. It's all about accessible content. It's not so much about signs and labels as it is making someone who has a vision impairment or has a hearing impairment comfortable in making them confident that when they go to the museum, they are getting access to the same content that is being provided others, whether it is audio, for example, in a museum of jazz or a museum focusing on music or just a one single museum display that has that has an audio component. And for people with vision impairments, again, it's all about allowing someone with a vision impairment to walk away from that exhibit with a sense that they understand what you were trying to convey. They understand the interpretive intent of the museum and what it is you have to offer. Next slide. I want to just touch on the Department of Justice Advanced Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, ANPRM, for equipment and furniture. And in that Advanced Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, the department here in the underlined language suggests they say, to the extent that ADA standards apply requirements for fixed equipment and furniture, the department will look to the standards for guidance on accessibility standards for equipment and furniture that are not fixed. And so here the Department of Justice is saying, yes, the ADA standards apply to the built environment. We're going to look to the ADA standards for guidance on things that may not be related to the built environment. I said earlier that we have assistive listening requirements for assembly areas. Well, in museums, you may have space that is not an assembly area as defined in the ADA standards. You don't have seating, but you may have lots of little displays that have audio components or visible components. The audio components may not be audible to someone who is hard of hearing. An assistive listening system with a very narrow reach right around that component could be a solution that you select. So again, DOJ is saying, we're going to look to the standards where there's something in the standards that fills the gap between the built environment and equipment and furniture. And so, for example, if you're looking at a kiosk of some sort, an information kiosk, it's likely that the Department of Justice will look at Section 707, ATMs and fare vending machines, for guidance in how that particular kiosk might be made accessible. Next slide. There's lots of technical guides on our site. We encourage you to use them. We don't have one on museum access yet, but we certainly have a good start on technical guides and technical assistance material for the built environment. And of course, most museums are first and foremost buildings, and then buildings filled with content that we also want to see accessible. Next slide. I'm done, and I'm now turning it over to Michelle, and thank you.
Great. Thank you, Marcia. And I want to congratulate Peggy, of course, and thank the U.S. Access Board and the ADA Network. I am honored to present my knowledge that I've learned from a lot of people and places, including the webinars from both the U.S. Access Board and the ADA Network. Next slide, please. So before I start into the meat of this presentation, I want to give you a little context of where I work. I work at the Harpers Ferry Center, which is located on the Harpers Ferry National Historic Park grounds. However, we are a service-wide center, and as Peggy had noted earlier, we provide interpretive media services to the parks. We have 400-plus national parks in our system. And that media includes everything from films, exhibits, publications, mobile applications, outdoor exhibit panels, which we call waysides. We do interpretive plans. We conserve artifacts. We create signs. So we're servicing all of the parks, and we're working with the private sector and contractors a lot to provide media to these parks. Next slide, please.
Yeah, Michelle,
slide 54.
We've had some requests for you to maybe increase your volume or maybe get closer to the microphone. Thanks.
Okay. Just let me know. How's this? Better? All right, well, let me know if it's still a little low. So I think that, as Marcia has alluded to in her last slides, physical and communication access are intricately connected. If you can physically access a facility or an exhibit, but you can't access the content, we've really missed the mark. So we try to really look at how we can make experiences enjoyable and accessible to everyone. Before going on, I do want to point out that some of the approaches that we provide for media access are, in my mind, very clearly spelled out. However, I think there's a lot that's not clearly spelled out. There isn't a cookbook for how to make exhibits accessible. So I'm going to start with some more obvious ways in which we make media and exhibits accessible, and then talk about other ways in which we're looking at other best practices, guidelines, and standards, and we apply them to exhibits. I also want to point out that this isn't a comprehensive sampling, and in fact, there are a number of examples here that I have that seemingly focus on visitors who are blind or have low vision. It's an area we're focused on a lot these days because exhibits are so visually rich and they're inherently visual. So that's part of our focus, but it certainly is not our only focus. Next slide, please.
Hi, Michelle. Sorry to interrupt you again, but I think people are still having a little trouble with the sound level. I think Claudia has recommended reminded people that you can increase the sound by moving the sidebar found in your audio-video panel. So see if that makes a difference, but perhaps you can reposition your headset one more time and see if we can get a little bit more sound.
So what I'm actually going to do is, hopefully this is better. I've changed from my headset to my handset, and we'll see if that works out better. Okay, so we're on to videos. Videos are very common in exhibitions. We use a lot of videos for short visual and audio experiences. We caption our videos in the National Park Service in our exhibits. We provide open captions. Online, we provide closed captions so that visitors using their own computers can adjust the font and the color of the captions to meet their needs. Open captions at sites and in exhibits mean that we don't have to worry about captioning equipment breaking. Nobody has to self-identify to push a button, and they're just available for everyone at all times. We also audio describe our videos for people who are blind or have low vision, and both captions and audio description are 508 requirements which we follow. Sometimes our videos don't have sound, and in those cases we want to communicate that to people so that they know that the captions aren't broken or that someone neglected to produce captions. We also provide assistive listening, and Marcia covered assistive listening some in her presentation. Sometimes we have dedicated theaters in our visitor centers, and we would consider that an assembly area with amplification. So we would look to the ABA standards, and we would provide assistive listening. There's no reason why we wouldn't apply that same practice to our exhibit videos. Slide 56, please. So it's great that when we go ahead and we provide audio description and captions, but we want to make sure that they're effective, right? So I'm going to start with audio description. Some things to think about are that we want to plan and produce programs to leave enough space to describe the visual information critical to understanding the content. If you have a video with wall-to-wall narration, there's no way we're going to be able to provide additional audio description of those points in the video that are critical, that present critical visual information. Captions, we of course want to make sure everything's spelled correctly, but we also want to design the real estate on the screen to ensure that text and other important visual information and the captions do not interfere with one another. So if you have the identification of a speaker who's being interviewed, you want to make sure that that text is somewhere that's not going to interfere with the captions so that the captions don't have to bounce from the bottom to the top of the screen, which is distracting and is not as effective for anyone who's using them or for those people who are not using them. We also want to include important audio cues in addition to narration, such as sound effects and music. Slide 57, please. Same sort of rules and requirements for us apply to audio programs. I have on the screen two pictures of an audio program at the White House Visitor Center. There are six options to select and hear stories from workers at the White House. You listen to this audio program through a handset, which is volume controlled, it's T-coil compatible, and when you finish and hang the handset back in the cradle, the volume automatically resets. The six selections are buttons that are numbered, and the number is also brailled. For people who are using audio description, the audio describer can direct them to the number, and if they read braille, they can identify which program they want to select through the braille. There's also a synchronized monitor, a monitor with synchronized captions. That is how we have chosen in this instance to provide access for people who are deaf or for people who are hard of hearing, who want to listen as well as follow along or who just want to read. Next slide, please, 58. So we can provide synchronized captions. We can also provide scripts and things like location, options, and access to electrical wiring, and the amount of audio content all matter and drive some of our decisions. Here I have two images of what we call a perimeter room in the Tuskegee Airmen National Park Visitor Center, their Hangar 1 exhibit. It's actually a record room, and as you walk down this hallway, there's a blackboard on the left and a telephone handset on the right before you get to a plexiglass barrier to look into this record room for the Tuskegee Airmen. In this instance, the only place that we could install a monitor for synchronized captions is in the hallway, so the monitor would be facing the wall and not into the perimeter room where the record room is and all the furnishing. When you walk up to that space, audio automatically triggers a program. So we wanted people to be able, if they weren't listening to the program, we wanted them to be able to either pick up the script or if they needed assistive would pick up the handset and be able to walk over to the perimeter room and either read the script or listen with the handset as they look into the room because the audio program is a combination of narration and sound bites from the Tuskegee Airmen talking about the use of that room. So regardless of whether you use captions or you use scripts, we want to make sure that the placement is at the exhibit program site. We want to make sure that a visitor doesn't have to go back to the visitor center desk to pick up a script. We want to make sure that they're at the experience and they don't have to break away from that experience. Signage is also helpful, and on the above the handset, we also have a symbol for assistive listening. I also want to make the point before going on to the next slide. In the White House Visitor Center, interestingly, anecdotally, I was told that when the rangers have observed visitors going through the space and using the exhibits, when they're interacting with the White House audio program, a lot of people aren't even picking up the handset. They're simply just reading the synchronized captions, or pressing the button, reading the captions. We don't know if all of these visitors have hearing loss or are deaf, but to us, it tells me that all visitors are just taking advantage of a different way to access the content. Slide 59, please. So moving away from audio programs and videos, we have the entire exhibit that we want to think about. As I said, exhibits are inherently visually rich with text, with photographs, with illustrations, with artifacts behind glass, which we'll get to in a moment. So audio description provides access to people who are blind or have low vision to some of these exhibit elements. I want to point out that it's really important to not just do exhibit audio description and think, okay, I've provided access now for people who are blind or have low vision. Their audio description is used in conjunction with other methods such as tactile models, which I'll be touching upon in just a bit. So exhibit audio description, and there was a question about exhibit audio description that was submitted in advance with some tips and approaches, and hopefully I'll be covering that for you in the next few slides. But it provides access to text and important visual information. It also provides orientation and wayfinding. So when you're in the lobby, and pictured here is the lobby area of the New River Gorge Visitor Center, the audio description would orient you to the space. It would tell you where the restrooms were. It would tell you where the theater was. It would tell you how to enter into the exhibit area, as well as providing description of the images and of the text. Slide 60, please. There's a lot of different audio description playback devices. I have on the screen four images of different playback devices that we've used through the years. Starting on the left is a handheld, essentially pocket PC type of piece of equipment that was developed by Disney. It's got blue tactile buttons underneath, which is how you operate the device. We've used this a lot in our exhibits. And one of the things that we really have appreciated with this device is it automatically triggers content as you're walking through the exhibit based on equipment triggers that are placed within the exhibit. So as you're walking through an exhibit area, you'll get a trigger for audio description. A lot of times we approach audio description by first giving an overview of an exhibit, and then we let people pick and choose, which is just what everybody wants to do in exhibits. There are streakers, strollers, and studiers in exhibits, and people who are blind or have visual impairments, people who have dyslexia who might use this audio description to have the text delivered to them in an audio format as well, want the same opportunities, or we want to give to them the same opportunities for choice. So this device allows you to drill down into different choices after you get an exhibit overview. Do you want to listen to the text? Do you want more description on photographs, on artifacts? This device allows that. Next to that is a chunky style pen or a stylus that someone's holding. It's probably a good inch or so in diameter. They're holding that next to a button. You probably can't see it. It does say AD, and it's on the leg of an outdoor wayside exhibit panel. And that's how the audio description is triggered. We've piloted this device, and we like it as another option because it's very low-tech, very easy to use, not a lot of buttons that you have to wade through or figure out selections. It's also a cost-effective solution. It does not trigger audio description automatically, so then we want to think more carefully about how we direct people to these buttons. One way is to definitely keep the placement of the button on these waysides consistent. Third, we are experimenting with mobile applications to provide audio description in the outdoors through GPS triggering that triggers content automatically as you walk through the resource. We're experimenting inside with the same triggering of audio description using iBeacons. And then lastly on this slide, I have an exhibit that looks like it's a wooden hutch, basically. On the top half of the exhibit is a video monitor. Below and to the left of that is a handset. And you pick up that handset, and it provides the audio description for you of this silent video. Slide 61, please. Outdoor audio description is something we do. It was something that we're capable of doing through our app. We also have other options, such as this audio solar panel, which is attached to the leg of an outdoor exhibit panel. Next slide, please. 62. So on this screen, I simply have an audio exhibit of an audio description script, which talks about or is an example to look to about how we approach our audio description by looking at the big picture and then drilling down. Also a part of the audio description approach for exhibits that we have to take is considering the equipment that we're using. There's information about how to navigate through the device to access the description that you want. Slide 63, please. So, of course, as I said earlier, audio description is one way to provide access, also wayfinding, mobility, and orientation. Maps are another way that we want to provide access. And there was a question submitted in advance about maps, so hopefully this addresses some of that person's question. Pictured here, I have two different maps for Valor in the Pacific, that exhibition area. They're both outdoors. One is a black and white floor plan of the exhibit area. It's very common to see maps of exhibit floor plans. We want to make them raised line maps so that people who are exploring the map through touch can also get a sense of the space. In addition, there's a four-color raised line map of the entire site area. It's got textures on it, different colors. It's got labels. It's got a legend. It has raised pictograms. It has braille as well as text. So legends are just as equally important for the sighted person. They're also important for people who are blind or have low vision so they know how to read the map. Next slide, please. 64. Approaches to maps that we want to take. This is a picture of the Baldrige Hall Visitor Center map for the White House Visitor Center exhibits. It's a very simple outline of the footprint of the building, some of the major building structures and exhibit structures. There, again, is also a raised lined legend in addition to the raised line floor plan that has text. It has raised line numbers, and it also has braille. And the raised numbers correspond, of course, with the location on the map itself. But a lot of work goes into these to think about how we make them simple and usable for everyone, as opposed to creating a lot of detail on those maps. Next slide, 65. So, of course, maps aren't the only things that we want to look at. In exhibits there, we also want to look at other tactile experiences. And there are a lot of artifacts and memorabilia that are behind glass cases. So how do we make those accessible to people who are blind or have low vision? In these two pictures on the screen, there are pictures of the USS Arizona Memorial, the actual ship, and the memorial that's suspended over that ship. They had made a model that was never intended to be touched. They made this model years ago, and they wanted to keep it in their exhibition. So we created a tactile bronze model of that that can be touched. And we got some user feedback in 2014, and I'm going to read that to you. This visitor said, "The tactile model of the USS Arizona Memorial was excellent. I had always heard that there was a turret exposed above the water, and it was nice to be able to see that part and where it was in relation to the memorial structure over the entire submerged ship." So this to us really kind of confirms that audio description by itself isn't good enough sometimes. This person had heard descriptions of the USS Arizona and the memorial and how it was situated. But it was actually when she explored the tactile, she made that connection. But this isn't just for people who are blind or have low vision. A lot of people like to make connections with stories, with concepts. In this case, really with sacred ground by touching the memorial. And I have heard it's a very popular exhibit for everyone. Next slide, please, 66. Tactile maps and models can be used in conjunction, and this is the attack room exhibit area in Valor in the Pacific. It's got a wall-length mural of an attack plane going in to or flying above the water at the ships that are at the port. It's got a reduced reader rail image of this mural that has raised lines as well as braille and text that identify the attack route. Suspended overhead is a reproduction of the airplane that you see on the mural. And also in the middle of the floor is a smaller tactile model of that plane. And the user who provided us with some feedback said, with regards to this exhibit, "The attack airplane sound at the entry of the attack museum was very good. Sounded like it was passing through the space, and you could hear the distinct splash sounds of something diving into the water. The tactile airplane was also good, as well as the mini anti-aircraft cannons." So again, it's not just one thing that we want to do. We want to create a multi-sensory experience for people so that they could access the content in whichever way speaks to them. Slide 67, please. So one size often doesn't fit all when it comes to tactile, and here I have two images of the White House Visitor Center and the White House models that we created. There's a really large White House model. It's probably 10 feet by 13 feet. It's not intended to be touched. There's a reader rail around that has a smaller, what we call massing model of the White House footprint. It's probably 1 to 2 feet long. That gives people a sense of the White House structure and footprint and those wings, the east and the west wings, which are really quite long. We also wanted to show architectural detail, so we wanted a larger model to do that, and that's the model that you see. It's on a separate table in front of the massing model on the reader rail. And on another table, we have a bronze tactile map of the White House in context of the larger President's Park area. And that White House is probably 1 to 2 inches. And that's to give you a sense of the larger area in which the White House sits. So oftentimes, one model can't do all of these things, and we have to create multiples. Next slide, please. Tactiles come in all kinds of different shapes and forms. We always want the content to drive the tactile. We want the content to drive all of the techniques we use. And this exhibit about the staterooms includes raised line maps. It includes some architectural details and details within the structure about the historic furnishings, including a section of horsehair upholstery, the detail on a fireplace mantle, and the ornate nature of a brass knob. Next slide, please, slide 69. This next slide is titled Bas Relief, Does It Work? We get a lot of folks who ask us and propose to do bas relief, and here I have a reader rail with four bronze tactile, I would call them high bas relief images of statues and monuments in Lafayette Park. The point and intent of these statues is not to go into the detail, but to understand their general form and structure to get a sense of how they populate Lafayette Park. But we want to be really careful about bas-relief. Bas-relief is not a replacement for a full 3D tactile. So again, we're always looking at what we're trying to convey before we create a tactile. The National Center on Accessibility did a project in cooperation with the U.S. Access Board on exhibit design related to low vision and blindness, and one of the papers that they produced, which is online on their website, includes some information about the effectiveness of bas-relief. Slide 70, please. So I think the bottom line is, in terms of good communication access and just good design, is that redundancy is good. So here I have an exhibit on the panel. The vertical panel is an illustration of the White House grounds. On a tabletop reader rail, there is a bronze tactile model of the White House grounds. And next to it are 8 flip panels, 4 in 4 panels in each row. Those flip panels have a number that corresponds to the illustration that's on the exhibit panel, as well as to the tactile map of the White House grounds. And you flip up each panel to see what kind of activity occurred or occurs in that part of the grounds. So you can use the bronze map, you can use the visual map, you can use them both in combination. Redundancy is always good. Options are good. I want to point out here, too, that, of course, it's not just about access to visual content. It's about how we engage in the content. So these flip panels, we took a lot of time to design them so that they were easily operable for people who have limited dexterity or mobility. We wanted to make sure they were operable with a closed fist. We also took extra time and decided that the back 4 panels that you flip up needed to be raised. So again, it's ease of use, so someone doesn't have to dip their hand down and back up to flip open those panels. And of course, our goal there, taking our cue from the standards, is that we want to make sure that to operate them, there's 5 pounds or less pressure. Slide 71, please. So tactiles can go outdoors as well, and my message here is that redundancy is interesting. This is a wayside panel in Sitka National Historical Park. It's got an almost 3D model of an adult salmon on this panel that talks about the life cycle of salmon. So this, I think, is engaging for everyone, but certainly if you have a visual impairment, or you learn through tactile experiences, or you're just a general audience visitor, this really brings the salmon to life. 72, please. So I think redundancy always also provides reinforcement. And here I have an image of a touchscreen interactive, which is also in the White House Visitor Center. I have a lot of samples from the White House Visitor Center exhibit because it's a relatively new exhibit for us, and it's one that we really paid a lot of attention to try and use as an example of an accessible and universally designed exhibit experience. This touchscreen interactive, there was a question submitted in advance about touchscreen interactives. This touchscreen interactive does a number of things, including giving you a virtual tour of the White House with the floor plans of the White House. We thought it was a really important idea. We worked with a number of consultants to ensure that we had tactile maps, raised line maps of these exhibit floor plans, which we present in the touchscreen. The touchscreen is also audio described, and we have redundant tactile operation. So there are buttons next to the touchscreen, so someone can either operate this program by touching the screen or using the buttons, and that works in conjunction with the audio description. And before I move on, I just want to point out that these tactile raised line maps are actually in a drawer that pulls out from the touchscreen. So that's also noted in the audio description for this exhibit experience. Slide 73, please. So what to me this all results in, it really is inclusive design. And there's a lot of work and language now around the philosophy or concept of universal design. It's now being called inclusive design or human-centered design. I do really like to go back to the definition of universal design that was developed by Ron Mace, which is the design of products and environments to be used by to be usable, excuse me, by all people to the greatest extent possible without the need for adaptation or specialized design. Slide 74, please. So Ron Mace and a group of like-minded people got together in the mid-1990s to actually create principles of universal design, of which there are seven. I have the URL of the poster that's presented on this screen of all the different principles of universal design. And for me, while it is a bit of an exercise, I think it's really interesting when you're designing an exhibit and planning an exhibit to look at these principles and see what elements correspond with these principles to kind of keep you on track about are you designing your exhibit with universal design standards and are you designing it in an inclusive way. Slide 75, please. So effective communication does not stop with accessible exhibits, the exhibits themselves. We want assistive listening and sign language interpretation for docent-led tours. We want to look at alternative formats of the printed materials provided at or about our exhibits. Regular and reoccurring training for staff and SOPs for the maintenance of equipment, I can't stress enough. We can throw as much technology as we want to create accessible experiences, but if staff isn't familiar with it, if there aren't regular SOPs and maintenance of that equipment, you know, the batteries go down, staff doesn't know how to use it, that people don't know where the equipment is, then we are no longer effective in our communication. Slide 76, please. So we want to advertise accessibility. Another submitted question in advance was, how do you let people know about the accessibility of an exhibit without singling them out? So I say you just want to design it into your exhibit. This is a picture of part of the information desk at the White House Visitor Center. We have symbols, the international symbol for access. We have a symbol for open captioning, for assistive listening, for audio description, for assistive listening where there is also an induction loop. We also have text explaining this. This isn't like a separate piece of paper that we slapped onto the visitor center desk. It is designed into the desk. It's part and parcel of the design itself. So I think that's how we ensure access, by advertising it and making it part of our regular design and advertisements of our experiences and opportunities. So that includes putting it on your website. It also includes things like public outreach to organizations in your local area or even nationally to let them know. And by organizations, I mean local chapters, for example, of the American Council for the Blind, other organizations that work with people with disabilities, to let them know that these options exist. Slide 77, please. So really, again, what all this is about is options and enjoyment. And here I have another image of two benches facing a video monitor in the White House Visitor Center exhibit. They are empty. The first bench has no armrests or a back. The second bench behind it does have a back and armrests. Of course, we want to make our exhibits accessible. We also want people to enjoy their experience of those exhibits and the content we've communicated. So we want to give them comfortable spaces and places to sit and relax. And that's what this does. So slide 78, please. We also want to remember that these benches are filled by people and they're used in ways that we don't necessarily always predict, but it's always fun to see how they're used, right? So on this slide, the quote I have from Design from All Europe is, good design enables, bad design disables. In these set of benches, they're filled with kids. There's a a child who's standing up with her arms placed on the back rest of the back bench. Two kids are resting back on that bench, and facing them on the other bench are some more kids. So we just created this social environment for this little group of people. Maybe they're talking about the exhibit. Maybe they're talking about the latest and greatest video game. I don't know, but we created and enabled a comfortable social environment in this exhibit, which I really like. Slide 79, please. So I can't help myself, and as I'm coming to the end of my presentation, I also want to look at the stories we're actually telling. When we're looking at inclusion and diversity in the stories that we tell, we often say and think, we need to, in our stories, be able to tell stories from multiple perspectives, from a diversity of people, and that includes people with disabilities. If we are creating an exhibit story and the person who's visiting the exhibit doesn't see themselves in that story, then they may not connect or engage. So here I have an image of President George Bush, who is signing the Americans with Disabilities Act. On either side of him are Evan Kemp and Justin Dart, who are wheelchair users. Of course, this is a audio described and captioned video. And it's a way to tell the story of people with disabilities in this video, which is about legislation. So why wouldn't we take advantage? The Americans with Disabilities is a really important civil rights piece of legislation. So why wouldn't we want to include it in the stories that we tell? And I encourage us to always think about how we can be inclusive in our stories. Page 80, or slide 80, please. So how do we get there? I believe we have to plan early and often. As I said earlier with our audio description, and captioning, you have to plan for those in advance. You have to think about it, not just in the early stages, but throughout your plan and design process. And we really need to not approach access as an add-on, but an opportunity to create dynamic, universally designed multi-sensory experiences for a multitude of diverse users. And I hope that some of these examples have illustrated how we can do that. Slide 81. So again, making accessibility part and parcel of the experience, I think, is how we get there. I have two screenshots of the Places mobile app that the National Park Service is piloting and using. This is the mobile app for Herbert Hoover National Historic Site. It's a mobile app for a general audience that provides you with information of the park, maps, tours, and interpretation. The second image of the mobile app is a screenshot of the birthplace cottage of Herbert Hoover. And in the middle, in the upper part of the app, is the D symbol for description. These places are audio described. And this is just part of the general audience app. We're trying to think about ways to include accessibility as part of the everyday experience. Rangers are familiar with this app, and they also enter text into a database system to create this app. The audio description is a requirement. It becomes part and parcel of the products that we produce. And that's really, I think, our goal as we move forward. Slide 82, please. So the National Park Service does have programmatic accessibility guidelines for National Park Service interpretive media that you can find online. I do also want to make a shout out for the Smithsonian's accessibility guidelines. We refer to them a lot. They have a lot of detail in there in some areas that we don't have, and those can also be downloaded from the web. And the last slide, please, 83. So I thank you for your time. On this slide is my contact information, including my phone number and email address if anyone has any questions or would like to follow up at a later point. Thank you. And I'm going to pass it back to Peggy now.
Thanks, Michelle. That was a great presentation. Gave a lot of practical examples. And we have been receiving lots of questions in the chat room. So I want to jump to those at this point. And I'm going to start with some questions that came in during Marcia's presentation. And two questions, Marcia, just about whether or not something's required. The first is the audio description sign required? And then secondly, is an assisted listening device mandatory in a visitor center?
The answer to the first question with respect to whether or not the audio description sign is required would be it is not required by the ADA standards. However, the DOJ ADA regulations speak to equivalent speak to effective communication, and without that sign, it might be difficult for someone to know that the service is available. So I think it's part of that whole approach that Michelle was talking about in terms of looking at the whole package, not just little components of a package. How is someone going to use this? How is someone going to be made aware? So while not required by the ADA standards or the regulations, certainly a good idea and would contribute to equivalent to effective communication. And the second question is about
assisted listening device
in a
visitor center.
In a visitor center. There's visitor centers and visitor centers. In Michelle's presentation, she talked about spaces that are actually auditoria. In an auditorium, for example, a lecture hall that is part of a visitor center, a movie theater that's part of a visitor center, any space like that is definitely an assembly area. And we tell you what we mean by assembly area in the ADA standards, and we bring some definition to that. So if it's an assembly area as we define in the ADA standards, then yes. But a visitor center that is just a hall where you have greeters, et cetera, or you have maybe some displays, again, the standards themselves do not necessarily require assistive listening, but you have to ask yourself, how will you communicate effectively? And assistive listening is certainly one of the tools you have available to communicate effectively with people who are hard of hearing. And for people who are hard of hearing who wear hearing aids, particularly people who wear hearing aids equipped with T-coils, the preference is most assuredly to be able to use the hearing you have and to use it effectively as opposed to having to read captions. In addition, you may have people who have more than one disability, low vision and hard of hearing, in which case requiring someone with low vision to read captions might not work out for you.
Okay, thanks. Now I'm going to jump to some questions that came in during Michelle's presentation. And Michelle, I wanted to go back to slide 60, where you were, it's the next slide. I think people would appreciate just another review of the different devices that you described here, and maybe some more information about who they were developed by and where they might be able to purchase them.
Sure, and my disclaimer is, of course, we're the National Park Service. I'm not here to promote any one single device, but I can certainly, tell you what the products are. The product that was developed by Disney is also made available now by Softech. It's a Duratec device. That's the handheld device with the blue raised line buttons on it, tactile buttons on it. The pen that we also have used and used at Sitka National Historical Park is called the Discovery Pen. That is another interesting product that had product development through with people who are blind or have low vision that was for lack of a better word, I'll say revised or developed for this particular use. Of course, the mobile application, we developed this mobile application framework, but it plays on a smartphone, any smartphone, iOS or Android. And then the other method for development is just a regular handset that you would find, a telephone type handset that you would find for use in any exhibit to provide audio.
Okay, thank you. Someone else asked about that they are exploring the wayside audio descriptions in remote public areas where there's no security, unlike where there might be a National Park Service where there is a level of security, and they wanted to know if you had any suggestions in this area.
And I missed the first part of the question. Were they exploring wayside audio description or just general options for accessibility?
Wayside audio descriptions in remote areas where there's no security.
Okay. If you go to the next slide, Peggy, I talked about also another delivery system, which is a solar panel. It's an audio player that has a little solar panel on the top that's installed right to the leg of a wayside. Now, this is in a secure location. It's actually on the Harpers Ferry Center and Park campus. We tested this this device because we wanted to see if it worked in cold weather, in the rain, and as well as in the summer seasons. It turns out it got hit by a snow plow. It's dented now, but it's still running. None of us can guarantee against vandalism. We do too have waysides out in remote locations. We wanted to test this option because it provides, it has the potential to provide access in remote locations where you don't have a visitor center or a place to distribute devices. Like I said, it is installed right to the leg of the wayside. So someone would have to be a little creative, I suppose. People are very creative, though, about vandalism. But this is one option that we think is viable. People ask me a lot of times, too, if they should post audio description on the web. And I think, redundancy, again, in how we provide information is great. So in addition to the solar panel, you can always also post things on your website so people could potentially download them before they actually go to the location.
Okay. And then someone asked if you could explain more about the project using beacons and other technologies for the location and wayfinding. Or can you tell the user where they are, for example? Can this technology tell the person where they are?
So both the technology or the smartphone application that we use in the Places app with iBeacons. Basically, this little iBeacon, and I should just throw in a little disclaimer again, as well as I can't promote products we use. We don't discriminate. We just use whatever is available to us and that's practical and for us to use. But I'm also not I'm not a super technological person. So I'm going to give you my version of iBeacons. They throw out a signal which connects to the program, in this case the app that you've programmed. When it receives that signal, it automatically triggers the file that you've associated with it. So we've placed these throughout the Herbert Hoover indoor exhibit area. We've had to do a lot of experimentation with the placement of the beacons based on the speed at which people travel through the exhibit, for example. We found when we first placed them, people would walk five steps and then they'd get another triggering of the audio description or a different audio description, which wasn't going to work. So there's a lot of experimentation that goes. guides for the phone, both a buzz, a vibration that lets you know there's audio description in the area, in the outdoors, and in the indoors. I believe it does that too, but I'd have to check because there have been various iterations of that. The one issue that doesn't work very well with iBeacons, or that I shouldn't say doesn't work very well, we haven't figured out yet, is how we would sync audio description. So the Duratech device that we use does sync with audio description for videos or for assistive listening. I don't think that we've figured out or been in a situation where we've used iBeacons where they're syncing with video programs that are in the exhibition. So the device like the Duratech, and there are also some other devices out there as well that other companies use that we have used too, they do sync with the audio. So it really depends on your exhibition and the content in terms of which equipment and technology you're going to use.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michelle. And unfortunately, we are now out of time, but we did receive other questions on your portion of the presentation, and I've left your contact information here on the slide for people who want to follow up with Michelle. Her telephone number is area code 304-535-6083. And the email address, Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-L-E, underscore, Hartley, H-A-R-T-L-E-Y, at National Park Service, NPS.gov, G-O-V. And for further questions, of course, related to Marcia's presentation, and we got to some of them. There was a few that we did not, but our hotline is available. Right now, you can make a call there, and if the person on the hotline can't answer the question, I'm sure they'll refer it to Marcia, and she can follow up with you. That number is 800-872-2253 or 800-993-2822, or you can also email a question to ta@access-board.gov. And I wanted to remind people that the session in January will be on protruding objects. Rex Pace and Erlene Seskar will be presenting that session. And I'm going to turn it back over to Claudia.
I also want to remind everyone, if you want to request a certificate, please send your request to certificates@adaconferences.org. This session has been approved for LACES. LACES does require that you do a continuing education quiz. You have 14 days, starting from today, to complete that quiz if you go to accessibilityonline.org and look on the right-hand side for CE quiz. You'll be able to find the quiz. Once again, you have 14 days to complete that quiz for the LACES. Our AIA provider number is also available on this slide. It's I017. And the course number for today's session is needed to track that in your AIA. That's GL20151203. Once again, any certificates inquiries can be sent via email to certificates@adaconferences.org. With that, we'll conclude today's session. You exit the webinar platform, click on the X in the upper right-hand corner. If you're on the phone, you can hang up and disconnect. Thank you, Peggy, Marcia, and Michelle. It's been a great session, and it will be a great loss to us. Peggy's now retiring. We've enjoyed what we had, but enjoy your retirement, Peggy.